We are going to continue the topic that we began last week, which was the arrest and trial of Jesus Christ. And so we looked at various aspects of that last week. I had a handout which is a paper that is a harmony of the gospel, so it has all four gospels, and they're all on the same page, and you can kind of keep track of the progression of things in through that particular document. So, unfortunately, there are no more. There are no more. If somebody has a copy, and I know if somebody needs one, we can run you a copy off here. We've got a copy machine, so we can do that. So if somebody needs a copy, because it does help to kind of keep everything in perspective. So does anybody need a copy? Okay, Mr. Douglas, Bill, okay. So if we could make a couple of copies, ask Mr. Steve Arnold to make a couple of copies. Why don't you make three? That way, if somebody didn't raise their hand, they'll be covered. So anyway, as you read through the Bible in the harmony of the Gospels, it does help you to put in perspective how things are unfolding and what's taking place and what each of the writers of the Gospels has to say about it, because they all were inspired by God and they have different perspectives and each adds something that the other doesn't. And John is especially unique. You have the first three Gospels that are called the Synoptic Gospels, which means basically they all have the same view. They have different things that they bring out, but it's the same view pretty much. So Matthew, Mark, and Luke are all synoptic gospels. John's gospel was written about 30 years after the other gospels, and he has a different perspective. Some of the things are similar, but he's very different in other ways in what he brings out, because he's had all that time that has progressed, and the church is at a different juncture than when the other gospels were written. And he brings out things that are crucial to understand in the context of his time. And we're not going to spend too much time on that, but each of them gives us a particular perspective. So the title of this sermon is The Arrest and Trial of Jesus Christ, and this would be part three. And we're going to begin today with the Son of Man. The Son of Man, let's go to Daniel chapter 7. And the Son of Man is important to understand because the Son of Man was predicted to come, and Daniel chapter 7 is where that particular individual is mentioned. Now, we can look at Daniel chapter 7 and see what it has to say about the Son of Man, and we know exactly who it's talking about, don't we? Daniel chapter 7, and let's look at verse 13. Daniel chapter 7, verse 13. So Daniel was given vision here, and he said, "I was watching in the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man. Coming with the clouds of heaven, he came to the Ancient of Days, and they brought him near before him." So who is the Ancient of Days? The Ancient of Days is the one we know as the Father. So who is the Son of Man? It has to be the other member of the God family, the one we know as the Logos, the one who came in the flesh. He became a flesh and blood human being, and Daniel sees him coming before the throne of God, and this could only be a spirit being who is coming before the throne of God. It says in verse 14, "Then to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom." So this we understand is to be future. He is going to be given a dominion and glory and a kingdom. He doesn't have that at this particular time. That is yet to come. But he's already won it. He's already lived his life. He's been resurrected from the dead. He's at God's right hand, and he's ready to come in all of his glory and to receive the dominion and the kingdom. It says that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion. It's not going to last 1,000 years or 1,100 years. It is going to last forever. He is going to continue to rule under God and to serve him faithfully. A kingdom which shall not pass away, and his kingdom the one which shall not be destroyed. So this is what it has to say about the Son of Man. So from a Jewish perspective, when they look at what it says in the book of Daniel, they're looking for this divine, eternal being coming to the earth and assuming power. That's what they're looking for. That's where they're coming from with that. They didn't fully understand that, but then you look at what's called apocalyptic literature. It mentions the Son of Man. And from their perspective, they saw this Son of Man as being semi-divine or a fully divine being. Now, we would say this is a divine being because of what we know from our perspective, looking at John 1 as an example. According to some of the scenarios, this Son of Man would come with conquering power, as I said, and would overcome the oppressors of Israel, the wicked, and would bring the kingdom of God and rule of God to the earth. We would agree with that. All right, and what the challenge comes in for them is, let's go to Matthew chapter 26, and we're going to do a little review before we get into that. Not everybody was here. Matthew chapter 26, verse 64. Matthew chapter 26, verse 64. And it says, and Jesus said to him, and so he's been asked by the high priest. Let's begin in verse 62 because it kind of fills in the gaps here. It says in verse 62, and the high priest arose and said to him, do you answer nothing? What is it that these men testify against you? So they were seeking to get false witnesses to bear witness against him so they could condemn him, because he could only be condemned out of the mouth of two or three witnesses. So they wanted to get witnesses that would witness against him, and therefore they could condemn him. And they wanted to condemn him of blasphemy, as we said last week. But Jesus kept silent. You know, one of the things is, as you're getting into trouble with your mouth, one of the ways to stop digging a hole is to be quiet. Because the more you keep talking, the more you get into trouble. And Christ knew that I have to be very careful what I say, because they're looking for any chance to pounce and condemn me. And so the high priest takes the step of saying, look, I demand that you answer. He says, I put you under oath by the living God. Tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God. So tell us, you know, I demand that you tell us. And so he basically is trying to force him to say something. So Jesus said to him, it is as you said. Nevertheless, I say to you hereafter, and was he the Son of God? Yes, he was. It is as you said. I say to you, hereafter you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the power and coming on the clouds of heaven. So he's saying, the Son of Man that you're all familiar with in the book of Daniel, I am that character. I am the Son of Man. This was just a completely outrageous statement. Now, why is it an outrageous statement? Because Jesus is a flesh and blood human being standing right there before them. The Son of Man was to be, as I said, a semi-divine or a divine being. And you know what? You're a flesh and blood human being, so you don't know what you're talking about. In fact, you're misrepresenting yourself. You are not the Son of Man. So the high priest tore his clothes, saying, he has spoken blasphemy. What further need do we have of witnesses? Look now, you have heard his blasphemy. So it was an outrageous statement, but he didn't use God's name in vain. In fact, he didn't use God's name. He used a euphemism that was common in the time, where he spoke of power. They all knew what he was saying, that I am the Son of Man. And this was outrageous to them. Now, it wasn't blasphemy, so they couldn't condemn him for that, or they would have executed him by stoning, as we know. So, and they were more than willing to condemn someone for blasphemy, because they condemned Stephen and they stoned him to death. So if Jesus had committed blasphemy, they would have all said, fine, we'll execute him by stoning, but they could not convict him of that. Christ, by using the euphemism of power in Matthew 26:64, did not use God's name in vain. He didn't use his name at all. Therefore, he didn't meet the legal criteria for blasphemy. So they're condemning him, and they're saying he needs to die, but they can't condemn him for blasphemy. And so they realize we're not going to be able to convict him on that particular charge. And they would have been more than happy to have convicted him on blasphemy if they could have gotten away with it, because it would have made life much easier for them. That's what they would have preferred. They didn't really want to go to Pilate, as there was no guarantee that Pilate was going to agree to them putting them before him and executing him. That wasn't an assured thing. It's like we live today, and if you go to court, and even if you have a good case, how many of you are absolutely sure you're going to win? No. We live in courts, and you don't know how they're going to go. No offense to any people that are attorneys. But anyway, they don't make the judgment. But, you know, you can go into court and you think, this is in the bag. And you walk out and you're like, what happened? You lost. And, you know, the judgment was decided against you, because I've seen it happen before, or heard of it happening before. And, you know, they were not sure that Pilate was going to agree with them and condemn Christ like they wanted him to. So they were all agreed that this man needed to be eliminated, but taking him to Pilate was an unsure and uncertain thing. So as we'll see, for them to get Pilate to condemn the Christ, they had to pressure him, and we'll see that as we go through here. So they were, if they failed, if they took him to Pilate and they failed to have Pilate condemn him, then they were even in worse shape than they were before. Because then you can't condemn him for blasphemy, you can't condemn him at all, and this puts them in a really untenable position. And they realize that it's very important from their perspective to get rid of Jesus Christ. So let's continue thinking about the term Son of God. As we look at the term Son of God, we understand that term from our perspective with all the scriptures, both the Old and the New. But they didn't understand it the way that we do. The Jews of Jesus' time had no understanding that the Messiah was to be God's Son, literally God in the flesh. They didn't understand that. So they had no such understanding of the Son of God in the way we do. And today, the Jews reject such an understanding as having anything to do with the Messiah. They still reject that the Messiah would be the Son of God. In fact, if you were to engage in a discussion with a knowledgeable Jewish scholar or a knowledgeable Jew on the point of the Messiah, he would say that Jesus couldn't have been the Messiah because he claimed to be divine. The Messiah was to be a man. He was to be a man. He was not supposed to be divine from their understanding. But Christ is saying he's the Son of Man, at least a semi-divine being, if not divine, and they didn't buy that, but the Messiah was to be a man. They were using the term Son of God in the sense that Adam was a son of God. God created him, and God was going to enter into a special relationship with him. When you look at David's time, David's son, Solomon, was to be a son of God. God said of Solomon, I shall be to him a father, and he shall be to me a son. That's the way they understood Son of God. They understood the term in one specific sense, not in the way that we understand it. So sometimes we could look at those terms and we see them from our perspective, but we have to realize that the Jews of Jesus' time did not see the Son of Man the way that we do, nor did they see the Son of God the way that we do. And Jesus was literally the Son of God by means of being begotten by God's Spirit. He was born of the Virgin Mary and lived as a flesh and blood human being, and at one time had been a fully divine member of the God family. And after 3 days and three nights in the grave, he returned to God's right hand where he is at this time. And as you think about the Son of God, there are all sorts of ideas about that in Christ's time. Just as there are all kinds of ideas in our time about religion and about God and Jesus and all of that. That's the way it was in that time as well. In Christ's time, some people believed there would only be a Messiah and that the Son of Man figure was fictional. Other people believed there would not be a Messiah, there would only be the Son of Man. You could take whichever side of the equation you wanted. But it was a fairly common idea that there would be a Messiah who would usher in a physical time of great blessings, and then the Son of Man would come. So there would be a time when the Messiah, who is a flesh and blood human being, would rule, and toward the end of his rule, all sorts of bad things were to unfold, and the Son of Man was to come and stamp out all of the evil. Now, we think that we don't understand where they get that from, but that's what they concluded, and that's how they looked at it. And they had it right to a degree. You also look at as the period that comes after the Son of Man returns, it's going to be kind of a new heavens and new earth kind of a time. But they didn't fully understand it all. They saw it as a physical scenario being enacted before the spiritual scenario came about. Now, the whole matter about Jesus' arrest in the beginning was not solely because they were jealous and they didn't like Jesus, which was true. They didn't like him, and they were jealous of him. And beyond that, they were horribly concerned because the people were convinced that Jesus was the Messiah. How do you know that? Because you see the acclaim to which Jesus enters into the city of Jerusalem. He comes into the city, and all of these people are saying Hosanna. They're waving the palm fronds. They're putting their clothes down, and the donkey's walking over it. And the fact that he walked into the city riding on a donkey was a clear symbol that he was the Christ. And they accepted that. And the religious leaders are outraged. And they see all of these people basically cheering and excited about this, and this is not good. This is something that's way too boisterous. And the Romans, when they heard all these people yelling as Christ is coming into the city, their ears perked up and they began to say, what's going on over here? And began to worry, well, maybe this is something that's getting out of hand. And whether you know it or not, Passover was a time when the Romans became very edgy. And they made sure that they had more troops in the city of Jerusalem because there were problems that broke out during that time. So you would bring in more troops to make sure that there were plenty of soldiers there to put down any problems that might occur. So anyway, they wanted to arrest him, and as we saw last time, Caiaphas was inspired earlier in the book of John to say that it was expedient that one man die, that the whole nation not perish. They were very concerned about this Jesus, and they needed to put him to death. And Caiaphas said that not knowing that he was actually making a statement where the Messiah was going to impact the whole world. So after they've arrested Jesus, and after they couldn't find evidence of blasphemy, they said, at least if he will admit of being the Messiah, we can say that we are not acting against an innocent man. And Christ did say that. And that's why the high priest said he's committed blasphemy, which wasn't accurate, but they could see that his statement was outrageous enough that this fellow has pretensions of being the Messiah. We need to get rid of him. And we can do this in good conscience. You know, if you do something that's evil, like what they did, if you can find a way to salve your conscience, you're going to do that. And that's what they did. Hey, look what this guy said. He deserves to die, and I can feel good about it. We're getting rid of this fellow, and it's perfectly okay. And, you know, as you look at, they say, we're doing this for the nation. Were they really? Their main concern was their power. Their main concern was their staying in power and the Romans not cracking down on them and removing Caiaphas as the high priest or removing the leaders in the temple from their positions. Because the Romans were quick to do that. Look, as long as you keep things running the way we want it to be run, then you can stay in office. But if you fail, you're going to be out. In fact, we may crucify you. So you need to make sure everything runs well. So they were very worried about their power, and they were also very concerned about what Jesus was doing. Jesus repeatedly pointed out how they reasoned in the law improperly. That's what Matthew chapter 5, 6, and 7 is all about, is all of the inappropriate conclusions that the religious leadership came to. Pharisees, Sadducean, they came to the wrong conclusions and allowed people to divorce, allowed people to hate and do all of these kinds of things that it talks about in those chapters. And Christ undercut them and pointed out, okay, you guys are reasoning improperly. And he also attacked them on the money issue. The cleansing of the temple was a direct attack upon the high priest and all of the people that were working for him. I mean, it was a cash generator for the high priest and the priestly class to sell the animals and to change the money. And it was all about the money. So when Christ drove out all the money changers and cleared the temple of the animals, that was affecting them, and they were quite unhappy about that. So they were very happy to get rid of him. They didn't feel he was the Messiah. He most assuredly wasn't the Son of Man. So if he had said he was the Messiah and said nothing else involving God's name, they couldn't have convicted him of blasphemy, which they didn't. And if he had said, yes, I'm the Messiah, and used God's name, they would have convicted him of blasphemy. But he didn't say that. And when you look at the meetings that are taking place here, one of the things that is probable is they didn't invite Joseph of Arimathea or Nicodemus to attend. Because both Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus had interactions with Christ. They had experience with him. And so they're going to be part of railroading Christ? I don't think so. So we don't need you guys to attend because you're going to give us an opposing view, which we're not looking for. We want everybody on board to condemn this fellow. So let's go to Mark chapter 15 and look at verse 1. Mark chapter 15, verse 1. So they've met through the night. Christ first went to Annas, who was formerly the high priest. Then they take him to Caiaphas, and they meet with in Caiaphas's home and question him. And then in chapter 15, verse 1, it says, immediately in the morning, the chief priests held a consultation with the elders and the scribes, the whole council, that is the entire Sanhedrin, and bound Jesus and led him away and delivered him to Pilate. So they had come to the conclusion that he deserves to die. And they couldn't convict him of blasphemy, so we will take him to Pilate and we will make our case before him, because this man needs to die because of what the threat that he poses for the nation. So we talked about last time that in looking at a few verses there, that the religious leadership of the Jews, as they took Christ to Pilate, they were disrespectful in the way that they addressed him. We talked about that last time. They were disrespectful. You might say cheeky is a way of being disrespectful. They did not treat him very well. And Pilate asked why they weren't judging him themselves. Why aren't you judging him? If he's wrong, if he's condemned, you judge him. And they knew they had no grounds to do that. And when Jesus mentioned, when it was mentioned that he was in from Galilee, he thought, all right, I can get rid of this guy and I can send him to Herod Antipas, which he did. And Herod Antipas couldn't find anything wrong with him either. He didn't find anything wrong with him, and he sent him to Herod Antipas. Because in that time, if Herod Antipas was there, Christ could be tried in any jurisdiction in the Roman Empire. So if Herod Antipas would take on the case, then Pilate was more than happy to let him go. That's more one less challenge that he had to deal with. So let's pick up the conclusion of Jesus' trial beginning in Luke 23, verse 13. Luke 23, verse 13. So here it says, then Pilate, so they've brought him back from Herod Antipas to Pilate. Then Pilate, when he had called together the chief priests, the rulers, and the people, said to them, "You have brought this man to me as one who misleads the people. And indeed, having examined him in your presence, I have found no fault in this man concerning those things which you accuse him." So he questioned him, and he didn't find fault with Christ. Pilate found no fault in Jesus touching those things that the Jews were accusing him of. He said, "You accuse him of being a rebel against Roman authority, a traitor, someone who is fomenting rebellion, and I don't find any basis for such a charge." Verse 15, he says to them, "No, neither did Herod, for I sent you back to him, and indeed nothing deserving of death has been found done by him." So he said, "I sent you guys over to Herod. Herod didn't find anything to condemn him for. And now he's back here." And basically Pilate is seeking to exonerate Jesus. He can't find a reason to condemn him. Luke 23, verse 16. He says, "I will therefore chastise him and release him." Now, if you look at the word for chastise there, it's interesting. It's the word paiduio, which is a word that is for training or for discipline, to educate, to train, to instruct. And, you know, it's found used in the book in Luke and in the book of Acts. And he doesn't find any reason to, so he's going to chastise him, he's going to punish him, and it's only used once here in Luke 23 for flogging, which is what they're going to do. They're going to chastise him, and they're going to execute him. Verse 17, it says, "For it was necessary for him to release one to them at the feast, and they all cried out at once, saying, 'Away with this man, and release to us Barabbas,' who had been thrown into prison for a certain rebellion made in the city and for murder." So John's gospel brings in the point that Barabbas was a robber. And what was a robber? A robber was a zealot. A zealot and individuals who were dedicated to overthrowing the Roman government. So he was a zealot. We know that one of Christ's own disciples was a zealot, Simon Zelotes, it says. He was a zealot, and the zealots were always about stirring up trouble in rebellion against the Romans. And so, interestingly, they were asking for the release of one who had been convicted of fomenting rebellion. So they wanted Christ to be killed for that very reason, but they had no problem with releasing Barabbas. And you don't think that that was going to stir up the Romans? It's interesting as you look at some of the hypocrisy and the double standards that they have. Luke 23, verse 20. It says, "Pilate, therefore, wishing to release Jesus again, called out to them. But they shouted, saying, 'Crucify him! Crucify him!'" So that's their goal, is to see that he is crucified. Verse 22 says, "Then he said to them the third time, 'Why, what evil has he done? I have found no reason for death in him. I will therefore chastise him and let him go.'" So I'll chastise him and let him go. Now, if you go to John's gospel, it says that Pilate took Jesus and scourged him. Let's go to John chapter 19 and look at verse 1. John 19, verse 1. It says, "So then Pilate took Jesus and scourged him. And the soldiers twisted a crown of thorns and put it on his head, and they put on him a purple robe. Then they said, 'Hail, King of the Jews,' and they struck him with their hands." So John 19, verse 1 speaks of the first scourging. I've mentioned that he was scourged twice, and this is where it speaks of the first scourging. You go down to verse 4 and it says, "Pilate then went out again and said to them, 'Behold, I am bringing him out to you that you may know that I find no fault in him.' Then Jesus came out wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe, and Pilate said, 'Behold the man.' Therefore, when the chief priests and the officers saw him, they cried out, saying, "Crucify him! Crucify him!" And Pilate said to them, "You take him and crucify him, for I find no fault in him." Pilate, in examining him as a judge, "I can't find any reason to execute this man. You keep accusing him and demanding that I crucify him, but I don't see any reason to do that." And he keeps seeking to release Christ. And they want him to be crucified, and he says, "You crucify him," which is something they couldn't do. The Jews had no right to carry out a crucifixion. They could execute him for blasphemy, but they couldn't execute him for being the Messiah or rebellion. The Roman government was the only one that could order a crucifixion. So Pilate knew that they could not crucify Christ. So why does he say that to them? He says it to them because there's not a good relationship here, and he knows that there's something wrong with this accusation. They're railroading this guy, and they want him to be part of it, and he doesn't want to be a part of it. So basically, he's expressing, we don't have a good relationship, and he's needling them. He's needling them. And the conversation is, and the whole relationship is turning nasty. John chapter 19, verse 7. The Jews answered him, "We have a law, and according to our law, he ought to die, because he made himself the Son of God." And basically, they're saying this to add fuel to the flames. They're saying that Jesus claimed that he was the Messiah. Now, he never did say that verbally, but he gave every indication he was the Messiah by riding into the city on the donkey. And he didn't say that publicly, but he did say that "I am the Messiah, the Son of Man." So, and that was the more outrageous claim. And their point was, how can you release him? How can you release this guy? He has claimed to be the Messiah, and you can't release somebody as the Roman governor who's made that claim. And Pilate, after examining him, said, "I don't think that you've got a valid claim here." And as you look at all this, this is where it gets interesting in John 19, verse 12. John 19, verse 12. He says, "From then on, Pilate sought to release him. But the Jews cried out, saying, 'If you let this man go, you are not Caesar's friend. Whoever makes himself a king speaks against Caesar.'" And the expression "Caesar's friend" is not just, he's not just saying words to be saying words. It has a particular meaning in the context of the time. It was a technical term. Caesar's friend meant somebody who was a loyal supporter of Caesar, particularly an appointee of Caesar who was distinguished by his loyalty. In fact, an honorific title that a person could be awarded was friend of Caesar, a man who had proved his loyalty in trying circumstances. He had been loyal and would receive this title because of his dedication and his loyalty. And he would be designated as Caesar's friend. And they are saying, basically, if you release this man, you are not a loyal supporter of Caesar. And as the governor, so what? What's the big deal? Why are they going to... So what if they say this? But interestingly, when Pilate hears these words, that they're going to come to the conclusion that if he doesn't execute this man, that he's not Caesar's friend, what does he do? Let's look at chapter 19, verse 13. "When Pilate therefore heard that say, he brought Jesus out and sat down in the judgment seat in a place that is called the pavement, but in Hebrew, Gabbatha. Now it was the preparation day of the Passover." That is, it is, from our perspective, it is the Passover. For them, keeping the Passover they eat their meal on the first day of unleavened bread, this would be the preparation day. And that was their perspective on that. And this is not the preparation day for us as Christians. For us, this is the preparation day. Tomorrow is the Passover. So, anyway, now it was the preparation day of the Passover and about the sixth hour. And he said to the Jews, "Behold your king." So why is he saying, "Behold your king"? Well, he's basically continuing to needle them because they didn't see Jesus Christ as a king at all. John 19, verse 15. "But they cried out, 'Away with him! Away with him! Crucify him!' And Pilate said to them, 'Shall I crucify your king?' And the chief priests answered, 'We have no king but Caesar.'" And it's interesting that these individuals say that, but they were adamantly opposed to the Romans. And now Caesar's suddenly become this great guy. You know, they're willing to manipulate the situation to get what they want. So Pilate's needling them, and he's on the brink of caving into pressure and trying to get back at them by getting them to endorse Jesus Christ as their king. And they're basically replying, "No, we're not going to be party to that. We're not going to admit that he is our king. We're not going to accept that idea of all. We have no king but Caesar. We are Caesar's loyal supporters." And then in verse 16 of John, it says, "Then he delivered him to them to be crucified. Then they took Jesus and led him away." So why does Pilate cave in? He's the governor of the province. He's the one that has all the power, and the soldiers, the Jews, don't. So why does he cave in to the Jews? Let's go to Matthew 27, verse 24. Matthew chapter 27, and look at verse 24. Turn over there, and we'll take a look at that. Matthew 27, verse 24. It says, "When Pilate saw that he could not prevail at all, but rather that a tumult was rising," so they're becoming more agitated, and the people with them are becoming more agitated, and this has the potential of maybe getting out of hand. And he realizing he was not prevailing with them. So what does he do? "He took water and washed his hands before the multitude, saying, 'I am innocent of the blood of this just person. You see to it.'" So basically saying, "I'm washing my hands of this, and it's going to be on you. It's going to be on you." And all the people answered and said, "His blood be on us and on our children." And there are all sorts of false ideas that have come about as a result of that statement. It doesn't mean all the evil things that have been attributed to the Jews. It's not that at all. It's just they basically, "We want him dead, and if that's what it takes, then we'll take responsibility for it." Then he released Barabbas to them. "And when he had scourged Jesus, he delivered him to be crucified." This is the second scourging. So let's see if we can answer a few of the complex questions here. First of all, why is it that the Jewish leaders feel they can be disrespectful to Pilate? Why do they feel that? Why do they feel they can get away with that? Secondly, why does Pilate cave in, even though as governor he's in charge? He could have just told them, "Look, I'm not going to condemn this guy. I'm going to release him. Over. It's over." But he didn't do that. And the question is, why is Jesus scourged twice? So we can answer everything but the double scourging with one simple understanding. Pilate was severely threatened, as we see in John's account in verses 12 and 13. There it says, "From then on, Pilate sought to release him, but the Jews cried out, 'If you let this man go, you are not Caesar's friend. Whoever makes himself a king speaks against Caesar.' When Pilate therefore heard that saying, he brought Jesus out and sat down in the judgment seat in a place that is called the pavement, but in Hebrew, Gabbatha." Okay, so you've said that, I know where you stand, and I know where this is going to go, and I really have no choice but to condemn him. And that's when he washes his hands, because he can't really see a legitimate reason to condemn Jesus Christ. And So he has there's a particular reason why he's susceptible to this blackmail, which is what it is. You know, and if, let's say that he decided not to execute Christ, and Christ has said he was the Messiah, then he knows that the Jews are going to send a report to Rome. And Pilate's going to send a report to Rome. Now, if the Jews and Pilate both send reports to Rome, who do you think the Roman authorities are going to believe? You would think that they're going to believe their governor. But the situation was that in all likelihood, they weren't going to believe Pilate. Pilate was going to be in serious trouble if this outcome came about. So that's where he caves. No reports to Rome. It's better to kill this guy than for me to get into trouble with the Roman authorities. Now, why is he in this circumstance? Well, he had done two very bad things as governor of Judea. First was, when he first became governor of Judea, the first season when he went up to Jerusalem at the time of the Passover, normally the standard was, which I'm sure that the troops explained to him, his centurions and others explained to him, look, when we go up to Jerusalem, there's a certain procedure. We don't march into Jerusalem with our standards as we would normally march into a city. We're not going into the city with the Roman eagle. We're not going into the city with the gods that are the gods of our particular military units. We're not going in there. What we do is we cover them up, we take them with us, we cover them up, and we store them in the fortress Antonia. But we're not going to march into the city. If we march into the city, there are going to be problems. So I'm sure they warned him, but Pilate, being kind of a stubborn, prideful type of individual, said, look, we're the Roman Empire. These standards and these gods go into every city in the empire, and we're here in this backwater place known as Judea, and we're going to cave into this? No way, that's not happening. We're not going to cave into that. So I want you to march into the city with the Roman eagles and the gods. And what happened? There was rioting and upset. Things got out of hand, and the Roman troops had to be brought out, and a lot of heads rolled. So they put down the riot, suppressed it, and a lot of people died. And what happened? They sent a letter to the Roman authorities and explained, this guy did not respect our religion. And it's a Roman policy to respect our religion, the religion of the Jews. So he was reprimanded for that, severely reprimanded. And then a second issue came up. Pilate kind of felt bad for what took place with the riot that took place at his first Passover. So he said, what I'm going to do is we don't really have adequate water coming into the city. So I'm going to build a second aqueduct which will bring water into the city, especially for the temple. So he begins the project, and like many public projects, he ran out of money. So he said, uh-oh, I can't finish the project that I started. So how am I going to finish the project? Well, he concluded, the project's for the temple, so I'll just take the tithes from the temple. And believe it or not, that did not go over well with the Jews. So he had more difficulties, and they again reported this to the Roman authorities, and the Roman authorities came back to Pilate and said, you have very poor judgment. This is the second poor judgment. You better be careful, because you won't be Roman governor for very long if we have another problem. So Pilate, you can see, is already on the bubble, worried about losing his position. And he realizes if the Jews report what's taking place here with him releasing Christ, this Messiah figure who could foment rebellion, that may be the third strike and I'm out. So that's why he caved. He was already having difficulties with the Roman authorities. So he once they threatened him by saying, "You're not Caesar's friend," then he thought, "That's it. I have to make a judgment against this man, even though that I cannot find a legitimate reason to condemn him." Later on, in an effort to sort of, as I said, he built the aqueduct. And now let's think about the double scourging. John's account indicates that he was scourged before he was finally handed over to be crucified. And Matthew's account says he wasn't scourged until after he was handed over to be crucified. So John says he was scourged before he was handed over. Matthew said after. So what do we have here? Did John get it wrong and Matthew got it right? Or Matthew got it right and maybe John wrote so long after the time that he got mixed up? What's the answer? Well, I don't think that one gospel account is wrong and the other one is right, or vice versa. And what we have is a double scourging, and the reason for it is given in John's account. As you look at what takes place in John, twice Pilate said, "I will chastise him and release him. I will chastise him and release him." In other words, I'm going to punish him, but I'm not going to crucify him. So he's seeking to strike a middle ground between full acquittal and full condemnation and of the charge of treason. So he would punish him, but he would not crucify him. And the Roman approach to things, there were two types of scourging that were administered by the Romans. The first was a punishment in itself. They would scourge, and was a typical punishment that was found administered by the Roman authorities. And if you look at the Romans felt that beatings did a lot of good. Remember what happened to Paul in the city of Philippi? Things kind of got out of hand, and so they arrested Paul, and I believe it was Silas, and beat them. They were beaten without trial. And then Paul let them know, "Wait a minute, I'm a Roman citizen." And the authorities are like, "Ooh, we're in serious trouble, because you could not beat a Roman citizen untried." So they didn't think, "Who's this guy? He's not a Roman citizen," but Paul, in fact, was. So and in that particular case, Paul said, "The city authorities need to come and themselves and release me. You're not just sending your messenger and letting me out. You need to come here," and in which they did. But anyway, they felt beatings were good and were effective. And when they beat you with rods, and that's what they did with Paul, you knew it. You know, it's like, most of us, we've probably experienced, some of us living in more barbaric times. We had our parents say, "You go get the switch. You go get the switch." And probably the first time we did that, they did not give us the criteria that it better be a good switch, because we would tend to get the little thin one that wasn't going to hurt much. "No, that's not going to get it. So go get a better one and make sure it's a good one." Probably some of you would have experienced that, because I did too. So anyway, that we went through that, so we had to get a good one, and then you were switched and you remembered it. But anyway, that was a different time, and that would never pass in our modern world. But anyway, that's the way it was then. And so they would beat individuals with rods, and when they were beaten with rods, you knew it. And when you limped out and were nursing those wounds for a while, you knew that you had suffered. And so what they would do is they would also punish by scourging. It was a less brutal kind of scourging that Jesus received later, which literally tore pieces of his flesh out. So he scourged him, and he brought him out to the Jewish authorities and said, "Here he is. Here he is." And he's saying, "Look, I don't see any reason to condemn him to death by crucifixion, which is the penalty for treason and fomenting rebellion. I don't see any reason for that. But look, I've scourged him, I've punished him, Is that going to be sufficient for you? And I will release him. And they said, no way. They want him executed. They're more than willing to have Barabbas released. Finally, Pilate is forced to go through with the full scourging and the execution of Jesus Christ. Traditionally, before crucifixion, people were scourged very badly. They were scourged unmercifully. And they were scourged so badly that in preparation of their being executed on the cross. So as we see that Pilate had hoped to let him go, they demanded he be scourged and crucified, and so they didn't accept the scourging as punishment. He had already been scourged once, so he was scourged a second time. And as you look at that scourging, you know, interestingly, we find out about it in Isaiah chapter 52, verse 14. God's, you know, that's why Christ went before God before he was executed, and he asked God to, if there was no other way, was there some other way that we can do this? And if you knew what was coming, as he did, you would want another way if it was possible. Isaiah chapter 52, verse 14, it says, just as many were astonished at you. They looked at him, and they were just astonished at what had taken place with Jesus Christ. So his visage, that is, his appearance, was marred more than any man, and his form more than the sons of men. Unbelievable what he went through. We haven't seen anything like it. And so many were astonished at what took place here. And he went through it, and verse 15 is worth reading. It says, so shall he sprinkle many nations, not only through the scourging. Kings shall shut their mouths at him, for what had not been told them they shall see, and what they had not heard they shall consider. Christ went through this horrible beating for all of us. And looking this idea of the scourging up, I found this from a Truth magazine by David McClister describing scourging. And he says, scourging, called verberatio by the Romans, was possibly the worst kind of flogging administered by ancient courts. While the Jews administered whippings in the synagogues for certain offenses, these were mild in comparison to scourging. Scourging was not normally a form of execution, but it certainly was brutal enough to be fatal in many cases. A person certainly could be beaten to death by the scourge if that was desired. Its purpose was not only to cause great pain, but to humiliate as well. And you know, the Romans had no positive feelings toward Jews. And this troublemaker, why are we going to look positively on him? So to flog him was perfectly okay. And to you have to realize Satan's in this. Like it said, Satan would bruise his heel, but Christ would crush his head. And all of this is to where for the purpose of ultimately crushing Satan's head, which he did through dying for our sins. To scourge a man was to beat him worse than one would beat an animal. It was belittling, debasing, and demeaning. And it was considered such a degrading form of punishment that Roman citizens were not subject to this. Only slaves and non-Romans, those who were viewed as the lesser elements in Roman society. To make it as humiliating as possible, scourging was carried out in public. The instrument used to deliver this form of punishment was called in Latin a flagellum or flagrum, and this was much different from the bullwhip that is more common in our culture. It was instead more like the British cat of nine tails, except that the flagellum was not designed to merely bruise or leave welts on the victim. The flagellum was a whip with several, at least three, thongs or strands, each as much as 3 feet long, and the strands were weighted with lead balls and pieces of bone. So they would wrap around your body and dig in, and as it's pulled back, it would rip your flesh. So the instrument was designed to lacerate, and this is what Christ went through. That's what he went through. That's what he knew was coming. And you know, as Christ walked through the area of Judea, Christ had to have been exposed to crucifixion. He had to have seen people crucified along the highways and byways of Judea. He knew this was a Roman form of punishment. And he knew as he walked along and watched people agonize that this was going to be his lot. And if you've seen this and you know this, you know that it's something, if there's another way, by all means, let's go, let's see if God can work it out. The victim of a scourging was bound to a post and was beaten, and which is what happened with Christ, and then he was taken out to be crucified. Let's go to Matthew chapter 27, verse 31. Matthew 27, verse 31. Matthew 27, verse 31. It says, "And when they had mocked him, they took the robe off him, put his own clothes on him, and led him away to be crucified. Now as they came out, they found a man of Cyrene, Simon by name. Him they compelled to bear his cross." So Christ could have easily carried the cross piece. It was, a man was capable of carrying it. But Christ had been beaten so thoroughly and was so weakened by what he went through that he couldn't carry it. So a man was taken from the crowd to carry it. So he goes out here and it says, "And when they had come to the place called Golgotha, that is to say the place of the skull, they gave him sour wine mingled with gall to drink, but when he had tasted it, he would not drink." So he goes out to be, he's taken to Golgotha. Golgotha, people conclude that that's the place of the skull. And it is the place of the skull. That's what it means. But it's not the place of the, that looks like a skull. It's a place where they counted skulls, which they did on the Mount of Olives. So they took him to that place on the Mount of Olives, which is right before the temple. So the door of the temple and God's where the Ark of the Covenant would have been, where God would have dwelled in Israel, God could look directly out at what's taking place here, the sacrifice that is unfolding before him, the place of the skull, the place where they counted skulls. So then Christ was on the cross for 3 hours from 9 to noon. Let's go to Luke chapter 23. Luke chapter 23. So they take him out. They nail him to the cross. Luke chapter 23, verse 33. It says, "And when they had come to the place called Calvary, they crucified him, and the criminals, one on the right hand and one on the left. Then Jesus said, 'Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they do.' And they divided his garments and cast lots." So Christ has gone through all of this with the Jewish leadership, Pilate, and now the soldiers, and he said, "Forgive them because they don't know what they're doing. They don't, you know, they're basically part of this world, acting under influence of this world, and they don't get to see the bigger picture. Forgive them, for they know not what they do." And amazing that you would have the wherewithal to think along those lines. But that's the way our Savior conducted himself. Verse 38, "And an inscription also was written over him in letters of Greek, Latin, and Hebrew. 'This is the King of the Jews.'" This was an affront to the Jews, an open affront to them. And then one of the criminals who were hanged, they were real unhappy about this, and they said they wanted Pilate to change it. And Pilate said, "I've written what I've written. I'm not changing it." Because it was true, whether they believed it or not. Let's go to Matthew chapter 27, verses 45 through 54. Matthew 27, verses 45 through 54. Now in the sixth hour, now from the sixth hour until the ninth hour, there was darkness over all the land. So darkness had come upon the land, and about the ninth hour, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, saying, "Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani," that is, my God, why have you forsaken me?" Now, did God forsake Jesus Christ? He did. He did for a moment, because Jesus Christ had to take the full brunt of our sins. And sin cuts us off from God, and Jesus Christ, in order to learn from all of the experiences of human life, had to learn this lesson himself, that what it's like to be cut off from God. He had never been cut off from God. He had lived eternally with God. And now as he's on the stake and the sins are being placed upon him, in their fullness, he was cut off for a brief moment from God. But we also have to realize that God did not forget Jesus Christ. God was well aware of him. He was still his beloved son. And both he and Jesus Christ had planned this out in order to bring salvation to all mankind. So he cries out, "Why have you forsaken me?" And he had been forsaken because he took the sins of the world upon himself. Verse 47, "Some of those who stood there when they heard that said, 'This man is calling for Elijah.' And immediately one of them ran and took a sponge, filled it with sour wine, and put it on a reed and offered it to him to drink. And the rest said, 'Let him alone. Let us see if Elijah will come to save him.'" So they're there watching this execution and still looking for some sort of a miracle to take place, and they can be there to view it. And in the harmony of the Gospels that I handed out, there's a quote from the 20th century New Testament, which, you know, if you want to check it out, you can look at online. It adds, "However, another man took a lance and pierced his side, and water and blood flowed from it." So, from the individuals who translated that particular version of the New Testament, that is part of the text. And so they plunged the spear into his side. And when they did that, what happened? As it says in verse 50, "And Jesus cried out again with a loud voice and yielded up his spirit." He died with that spear being plunged into his side. And what took place after that? What took place as he died and yielded up his spirit? His blood poured out on the ground. You know, if you go back to Genesis chapter 15 and you look at the covenant that Abraham entered into at that time, it talks about these animals being cut in half, being sacrificed, and their blood being poured out on the ground. That was a type of what's taking place here, with this spear being plunged into Christ's side and Christ dying. But what took place as Christ died? It says, "Then behold, the veil of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom, and the earth quaked and rocks were split." Why did the temple curtain split from top to bottom at that time? Because the way was open to the throne of God. The way was open for man to come boldly into God's throne room at that moment. And the veil was split in two. Now, how would they know that? They would have had to have seen it. So you have to have soldiers that are in a position to be able to see this take place. So they note that Christ died. The blood spills out on the ground. And as they look around and this earthquake is taking place and rumbling, they can look in the doors of the temple and they can see this curtain split. Something dramatic, something amazing is taking place. It says, and the graves were opened, and many bodies of the saints who had fallen asleep were raised. They weren't raised to spirit life, they were raised to physical life. were raised to physical life, and coming out of the graves after his resurrection, they went into the city and appeared to many. So when the centurion and those with him who were guarding Jesus saw the earthquake and the things that happened, they feared greatly, saying, "Truly this was the Son of God." They saw it. They saw all of this unfold. Were they Christians? No. But they saw something amazing take place and must have recounted it to someone. Let's go to John chapter 19. John chapter 19. John chapter 19, and let's read verses 30 through 37. So when Jesus had received the sour wine, he said, "It is finished." So everything is done. Everything is done. And bowing his head, he gave up his spirit. So if you read that, you think, well, why did he give up the spirit? He just died? What caused his death? If you put it together with what was said in Matthew in the 20th century New Testament, you see that the spear which plunged into his side, that's what killed him. And it alludes to that here a little further down in John's account, verse 31. "Therefore, because it was the preparation day that the body should not remain on the cross on the Sabbath," and they didn't want it on the cross on the first day of unleavened bread. So this is the Passover. They don't want the body on the cross on the high day, as it says. "For that Sabbath was a high day, the first day of unleavened bread. The Jews asked Pilate that their legs might be broken and that they might be taken away." So typically, when they came up to an event like this, they would break their legs and you couldn't hold yourself up anymore and you would suffocate. You couldn't breathe. "Then the soldiers came and broke the legs of the first and of the other who was crucified with him. But when they came to Jesus and saw that he was already dead, they did not break his legs." Amazing that he was dead already. But why? "But one of the soldiers," it would be a better read, "had pierced his side with a spear, and immediately blood and water came out." So he had been speared, the blood came out, and because of his loss of blood, the life is in the blood, he died. As he said, he gave up the spirit. "And he who has seen has testified, and his testimony is true." John was there. He saw this. He saw this unfold, as did others. They saw exactly what happened. "And he knows that he is telling the truth, so that you may believe. For these things were done that the scripture should be fulfilled. Not one of his bones shall be broken." Not one of his bones shall be broken. If they had broken his legs, he wouldn't have been the Christ. And again, another scripture says, "They shall look on him whom they pierced." He died by having his side pierced and his spirit returned to God. So as we come together tomorrow night for the Passover, we come together to recommit ourselves to the covenant that we entered into at baptism. We're recommitting to that and to walk before God in humility as bondservants to God and Jesus Christ and to our fellow man. And as we break the bread, it's symbolic of Jesus' broken body, that terrible beating that he went through. He was broken through the scourging. And finally, we partake of the wine, symbolic of the blood of Christ, which covers our sins. Christ is our Passover. And it is through his sacrifice that we can be cleansed of all unrighteousness. And as we come before God and we partake of these symbols and participate, it's not because we deserve it, but it's because we've taken the time to examine ourselves and to judge ourselves, and then we can come before God and partake of the Passover. The whole purpose of judging ourselves is to prepare to partake of the Passover. And what a great and wonderful gift is the sacrifice of Jesus Christ. So I hope that taking of the time to go through the arrest and the trial and execution of Jesus Christ will be beneficial to you. I hope that you found it profitable. I appreciate your attention. And Please have a wonderful remainder of the Sabbath day. We'll look forward to working with those who remain behind to help prepare for the Passover and the days of unleavened bread. So please have a wonderful remainder of the Sabbath, and we look forward to the days of unleavened bread and all that they symbolize for us. Yeah.